From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Argusia in for Celeste Headley. Police officers don't always make innocent people feel safer.
I was in the ninth grade, and we had a basketball game, so I was fully dressed with my sweats, my shorts on, and this white police officer just rolls up really fast and stops his car and jumps out.
Hear the rest of that story ahead this hour. That was Amir Muhammad of Atlanta. He'll talk with his 14-year-old son, Fahim, about interacting with law enforcement. But first, this week we'll talk a lot about gun ownership in Georgia.
Well, it made me feel super powerful. Like, if I heard anything at all in the front or the back door, I could grab this weapon and then say stop or I'll shoot and then shoot.
That was Heidi Purvis from Macon. We want to know how you feel about guns. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook and we might feature your comments on the show. Earlier this year, a federal court ruled for the first time that workers cannot be fired on the basis of sexual orientation. A Chicago judge recently extended workplace protections in the Civil Rights Act of 1964 to the LGBT community. Yet a Georgia judge ruled against a similar case. It's now up for appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Jamika Evans claims that Georgia Regional Hospital in Savannah fired her for being a lesbian. Earlier this month, 18 state attorneys general filed briefs in support of Jamika Evans' petition. We spoke to her attorney, Greg Nevins, in May. We were also joined by Andrea Young, director of the ACLU of Georgia. They've filed a friend of the court brief on Evans' behalf.
So, Greg, most of us don't understand the legalities behind this. It is legal at this point for an employer to fire you in Georgia because you're gay or for almost any reason. Isn't that right?
Temporarily it is until we get but I mean the momentum is really moving in our favor, and actually what's interesting is that a lot of American people really do understand this, because most people think it's already illegal under federal law, and I think what they understand is that if you can't discriminate against someone because of their sex, then how can it be possible that, you know, a man marries a woman and everyone congratulates him, and if a woman marries a woman she gets fired? I think the average person says, well, that can't possibly be right. It's got to be, you're treating people different, treating a man and a woman differently. And that's what the court in Chicago said. They didn't rewrite the law. They just said, well, that of course is treating people differently because of sex. And that's what we want the 11th Circuit here in Atlanta to do.
There are complications though, Andrea. And before we get a little further into those, because this might come up, can you explain what Title VII is?
So the Civil Rights Act of 1964 included a prohibition on discrimination in employment based on race, and gender was added actually sort of as a poison pill, because at that time, discrimination against women in the workplace was
totally
the
okay.
rule rather yeah. than the exception.
We've all seen Mad Men. Yeah.
Right? So we're looking at an interpretation now of what does that mean. It's been applied, of course, to women. Discrimination against, because you're a woman, you can now, you know, go to all different colleges. You know, colleges are open. Job classifications are open. We've had suits against the police for discriminating, you know, against women, and having rules that prohibited women, prevented women from being able to take those job classifications. Even now, the military, we have women in combat. So this has been a long journey for, really looking at equal opportunity in employment.
Since you mentioned equal opportunity, let's talk about the Equal Employment mm-hmm. Opportunity Commission. Mm-hmm. But first, I want to say that we did reach out to Georgia Regional Hospital. They said we are unable to comment on any litigation matter, not surprisingly. As I mentioned, a former employee is suing Georgia Regional Hospital in Savannah, claiming that she was fired because she is gay. So let's talk about, Greg, the difference between state law and federal law, and where the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission comes in, the EEOC.
Right. Well, and Georgia is an aggressively at-will state. But and what that means is that, you know, you can be fired for any reason, including a bad reason or no reason at all, but except a reason that's illegal. And so, in other words, if when federal law says that you cannot fire somebody because of their race, color, religion, national origin, or sex, that does trump state law. In other words, so that state law recognizes that if the federal law says that, then that is what the law is. So the federal law protections, including also disabilities, there's the Age and Discrimination Employment Act as well. So there are different categories. But if federal law says you cannot do it, then you cannot do it.
So this, I already know because I've been asked this question, it leads to confusion sometimes because, Andrea, it was a federal court in Chicago that decided that you can't be fired based on sexual orientation. Why doesn't that then apply everywhere?
Well, because the circuits govern the law within their geographical determination. Now, the circuits do look to others, and that'll be one of the important factors that will help the petition for rehearing, because we're saying to the 11th Circuit, why if this is so clear, our argument has been accepted in Chicago. But when there's a conflict among the circuits, then it's the Supreme Court that makes a decision.
And the circuits are often overturned mm-hmm. by mm-hmm. Supreme Court decision. Greg, that takes us to the difficulty of proving this kind of case. And it is very difficult to prove that's why someone has been fired. Is it not? How do you prove, because you've done it once and you're trying to do it again, right? How do you prove that somebody was fired because they're gay?
And I should clarify, because sometimes this is the Seventh Circuit, the court in Chicago did not rule that my client, Kim Hively, had been discriminated against. She was thrown out of court, the court saying, like, we don't care whether you were discriminated against because you're a lesbian. You don't have a case. So we had to fight just to get her right to bring a case in court. In other words, if you were fired because you're black, you're Hispanic, you're Jewish, or anything, no one questions that if you go into court and that is your theory, that's what you say happened. You actually have a claim. What the courts had previously said is if you say you're fired because you're lesbian, you have no claim. You can't be here. So we're fighting right now just for the right to be able to litigate that claim in court. So you have won
the right to litigate it in court
in Chicago, in the Seventh Circuit, which covers Illinois, Wisconsin, and Indiana. But as was said previously, that was the full court. So in other words, the entire Seventh Circuit, the way we're asking the entire 11th Circuit to do it, that the circuits actually don't sit with all the judges in the circuit together very often. The Seventh Circuit is an extremely respected court. It has probably some of the most prominent names, of federal judges in the country that aren't sitting on the Supreme Court. And so the win there is going to have an outsized influence, I think, because it is such a respected court. But I mean, it is technically is only binding on the three states: Illinois, Wisconsin, and Indiana.
I'm speaking with lawyer Greg Nevins and ACLU Georgia Director Andrea Young. And give us your thoughts on this. Should it be illegal for an employer to fire someone because they're gay? You know how to reach us. You can call us at 404-500-9457 or tweet us. Now, Andrea, we have the prospect of passing a religious liberty bill in Georgia. And already our president has signed an executive order dealing with religious liberty. One of the religious liberties is exactly what we're talking about, the fact that if you have religious objections to employing someone who is gay, that you should be allowed to let them go. You're making a face, but...
I'm making a face because, we've heard this before. There were people who thought God intended the races to be separate, and that's why God put them on different continents. And so this is an old discussion that your religious freedom does not allow you to be free to discriminate against other people in public spaces. If you're offering services to the public, then we have standards in this country around non-discrimination, and religion should never be used as a pretext for discrimination. We resolve that, I believe, with the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
And yet, we didn't really resolve it, right? Because it's only now that even any court has recognized that being gay should be included in the classifications of the Civil Rights Act. So, Greg, what do you think convinced them?
Well, basically, it was asking the question in the right way, because here's what we have: as the words sexual orientation are not in in Title VII. So, and that's what courts used to obsess about. They used to say, like, well, if those words aren't in there, then you don't have a claim. What they forgot about was that the word sex still is in the statute. So they never answered that question. Is this discrimination because of sex? Are you treating a man differently than you're treating a woman? And once they, now that they've actually asked that question, they go like, oh yeah, we kind of got that wrong. Because I mean, everyone knows it absolutely would be illegal to fire a woman because let's just say she plays rugby, she's considered masculine. The law is very well established on that front. So why is it okay to discriminate against her because she breaks another stereotype or another something else that you would treat a man differently? She dates women. Right. So once they understand, once they look at it the same way, instead of obsessing about words that aren't in the statute, obsessing about Congress is not passing these amendments, and they actually ask the question, is our law about sex discrimination consistent? Now the light bulb has gone off, and actually it's been impressive how quickly the courts have realized that a whole bunch of bad case law from the past was just wrong because they focused on the wrong question.
I think there's a lot of important, the conceptual shift is about this idea of gender conformity. So if you're being required to conform to someone else's notion of gender appropriate behavior, then that's sex discrimination.
And yet some employers still can require a woman to wear heels. I guess that's our next battle.
Well, yes.
ACLU Georgia Director Andrea Young and also lawyer Greg Nevins of Lambda Legal. Greg successfully argued a case in court in Chicago that ruled workers cannot be fired based on sexual orientation. And there is a case here in Georgia as well against Georgia Regional Hospital. Thanks so much to both of you.
Greg, glad to be here. You. Thanks for having us.
Just ahead, what happens when a family's relationship with law enforcement sours? But first, Rhiannon Giddens gets her propers for making the kind of music that you need to hear. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. This month, North Carolina-based singer-songwriter Rhiannon Giddens was announced as a MacArthur Foundation Fellow, better known as a Genius Grant winner. That comes with a $625,000 cash prize. You may know Giddens as the voice of the string band, the Carolina Chocolate Drops. The group rose to fame with the hit Country Girl.
I was raised in the country, that's a natural fact. Food on the table from the garden out back. Everyone working to make the land their own. Red clay cracking with a a queen grows, running with your cousins from yard to yard. The living was easy, but the playing was hard. Didn't have much, nothing comes for free. All you needed was your family. I am a country girl. I've been around the world.
Rhiannon Giddens' second solo album, Freedom Highway, came out in February. My colleague Celeste Headley spoke with her before an Atlanta performance.
Folk music is not a genre, at least in the United States, that's traditionally associated with African Americans. Most people who sing folk music or sing with a string band have been white in the past. Do you think there are still obstacles for people of color in this genre?
Well, I think that's, it depends on what you're considering folk music. If you're considering it the commercial, you know, resurgence of acoustic music that happened in the 60s, say with like Joan Baez and Bob Dylan, yeah, it was overwhelmingly white, even though there were black folk musicians in that commercial world, you know, like Odetta and Joan Eddy. And of course, so many people were influenced by Lead Belly. So, you know, when you talk about folk music as an American genre, as an American thing, it's been heavily influenced and populated by African Americans, but the common idea of it is absolutely more of a white sort of singer-songwriter kind of thing. And so that perception is very challenging as a black folk singer to sort of have to overcome, because we have to have these questions instead of just getting to the music. We have to talk about, you know, why don't black people play the banjo, and why are folk musicians considered white? So it is a problem, because it does get in the way of the history, which is very, very clear in what, you know, African Americans' roles have been.
Yeah, I would never ask you why they don't play the banjo. I mean, the first classical composer to include a banjo in a symphony was William Grant Still, an African-American composer. But that, speaking of classical music, which is how you trained, right? You're a classically trained singer from Oberlin. That's another place in which we can talk about the influence that African-Americans had, which was outsized even in classical music. And yet, when you talk about legends of classical music, you're almost never talking about William Grant Still. And I wonder if that has an effect on a musician. In other words, as a musician, how much does your role model, how difficult is it to find role models?
I mean, it is difficult, and they don't encourage it. You know, maybe they do now, but when I went to school, you know, the idea of black classical music wasn't really a thing, and just knowing, you know, the giants who, you know, were classical trainers, Sister Jones and you know, who's called the Black Patty, and you know, all these people who were there, you kind of get there and you think, oh, I'm just, you know, sort of inhabiting this white world, and that's not true at all, you know, because in the beginning, after emancipation, I mean, that was one of the most sought after things, was classical music, because that was seen as like the pinnacle of Western art music. So, you know, African Americans have been involved in that since, you know, since emancipation. So, or even before, you know, talking about free people of color in the North. So, you know, the thing is that we've been doing this stuff for a long time, and, you know, it colors, pardon the pun, you know, your idea of what your people do if you don't know that. You know, we are told in the narrative, there's this narrative of American music that's sort of told, you know, to everybody. And it's, you know, black people contributed like spirituals and, you know, blues and jazz, and that's it. And it's like, it's way more complicated than that. You know, every American genre has been a combination of, you know, cultural crossroads and cultural influence, but so much of the core of so many American genres does lie within the African American community. And, you know, even those genres that don't have much color today, like country or, you know, old time music, or, you know, even jazz at this point, you know, it's it is an issue, because, you know, it does color, like, as a black musician, you know, if you don't know that stuff, you feel like, I mean, when I was going into old time music, I was like, well, this isn't my music, but I'm just gonna like get in here because I really love it. And then I started looking at the history, and I was like, oh, what? We invented the banjo? What? You know, like, why wasn't I told this? And you have to seek it out. And then once you seek it out, you find this amazing history, which is actually much more interesting than the history that you're told. I mean, it's much more American. It's much more vibrant. It's much more complicated, you know.
And colorful.
And colorful, exactly. And inspiring in that way.
So then let's get to the music, which, you know, there's things that you're able to do with your voice, which I have to feel you owe to your classical training. There's, you know, even in the breakout performance of Waterboy, the ability to go from to crescendo and decrescendo the way that you do all in one breath, that takes some training.
Whoa! Where are you hiding? If you don't come right here, I'm gonna tear upon you. There ain't no hammer that's on this mountain.
How has the classical training sort of either helped you or has it hindered you at all?
No, I mean, it's been nothing but great. I mean, the only issue I had to deal with was learning how to use a mic, you know, and that was...
Yeah, because opera singers go micless.
Yeah, you know, our whole training is to not use a mic, and so I feel bad for my first band. They were very patient to learn how to use a mic.
As you blew out their amps?
Yeah, but... You know, I'm very grateful for my training, you know, and I'm also grateful for the fact that it came later in my life. I didn't start out wanting to be an opera singer, at 10 or 12, that it wasn't until I was in college that I really learned classical music and learned how to sing, you know, in that way. And I'd been, singing with my family before that. So I had this pre-classical idea of how to sing. So, you know, when I started branching off and doing other music, I could combine what I had learned, you know, in the classical world and figuring out how to make that, you know, support rather than to overwhelm. Because, you know, there's not a lot of classical singers who can cross over.
Yeah.
You know, it tends to take
there,
up your
many
entire...
That, there are many that try.
Yeah, there are many that try and they don't succeed. And that is because, you know, to be, you know, a top singer, you have to give everything to that. And I was able to do enough at Oberlin. I did a lot of operas and some more at UNCG. I was able to, you know, really get that experience of being a classical singer and that I can still sing with the symphony. I can still sing in that way. It didn't overwhelm me or overtake me to the point where I can't disengage. So I use, you know, all of the wonderful things that I learned, the breath control and the mouth positions and all that stuff to support this other kind of singing so that it doesn't overwhelm it. You know what I mean? So that it supports it rather than overtake it.
So this album in some ways is really different from your first solo album. And in some ways they're kind of all of a piece. And by that I mean that the first album you were singing songs made very famous by some really strong voiced and strong willed women. And in this album you are telling stories of people going even further back in history. Mm-hmm. And what is this, I guess this desire you have or urge to honor those who have gone?
Well, I tell you, you know, I'm a woman of color in 2017, and when I read history, I'm aware of my privilege. You know, I'm aware of the ability that I have to marry whoever I want, to get whatever job that I qualified for, to, you know, be able to hold on to my children and not have to think about them being taken away. You know what I mean? It's like, it's really not that far away, number one. And number two, it's, you know, what do you do with privilege? You have to acknowledge it and you have to have a responsibility. That's what I feel anyway. Because we all have privilege in different ways, you know, because there's people out there today who don't have the privilege that I have. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
There's people who are born in situations that are not as freedom, you know, giving as mine has been. So it's like, it's not only responsibility to other people who aren't as lucky, but it's also responsibility to the people who came before me, who sacrificed so much so that I could be where I am. And I feel like if I'm not using my position to tell those stories, then I am not being responsible. I am not, you know, paying my debt, you know, because like I get to wake up in the morning and not be owned by somebody. You know what I mean? I get to not worry about, you know, being accosted or being, you know, being forced or any of that kind of horrible things that, you know, all, like so many of my ancestors had to deal with. And so I just feel like it's my job then to tell those stories. And I'm a musician, and I've got this sort of unique background that means I can tell them in a way that maybe they haven't been told before, you know. And I really feel that way pretty strongly. It's like, that's why I'm here. That's why I'm a musician. I mean, I'll sing love songs because I love them and they're great, but like, that's not my mission, and that's not the core of what I'm doing right now.
I'm talking with singer and songwriter Rhiannon Giddens. You may know her as the lead voice of the string band The Carolina Chocolate Drops. She's got a new solo album, though. It's called Freedom Highway, and it tells the stories of oppressed African Americans throughout history. In the song Julie, Rhiannon sings about a slave owner who says she loves her slave named Julie, even though the owner has sold Julie's children.
Julie, oh Julie, won't you run? 'Cause I see down yonder the soldiers have come. Julie, oh Julie, can't you see? Them devils have come to take you far from me.
When I was listening to the song Julie, which is just, it just wrecks you. And I wonder if she plays this to her kids. I wonder if they understand what this is about. 'Cause that's difficult. No matter how light-skinned your kids are, going back just a few decades, they would have been subject to Jim Crow laws. Do you talk
Absolutely.
About this stuff?
It's really interesting. You know, they're starting to feel the difference because, you know, their dad's Irish. So,
yeah.
You know, 1,000 years of Irish genes sure beat the crap out of my melanin, you know? So they're pretty pale. And they're starting to feel that difference of, you know, hey, mom's darker than we are. And my daughter in particular, because, you know, she feels an affinity to me because she's a girl. And, you know, I took her to the African American Museum in D.C., which is intense. I mean, it's amazing. And she was just like, you know, I look like you. You know, she's like holding up her arm to mine and going like, I'm closer to you. You know, I'm not white. And I was just like, whoa, like that blew my mind that she's already feeling that division and feeling that, you know, I don't know. It was just, it's just really interesting. It'll be really interesting to see how they deal with it, you know, because they do look white, and in the eyes of a lot of people, they would be, but they are, you know, and you know, 50 years ago, they wouldn't
have been called,
you know,
octoroons or something. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there were so many terms for how much, like, what little drop of black you had in you. I mean, it's just so amazing. There's stories of people who were actually white, who were, you know, mistaken for people who were not white, but like had a drop in them and were enslaved. I mean, it's just the history of racism and the color issues are so, it's unbelievable when you look at it and you're just like, I can't believe we have divided, you know, we made so much division based on color when color means nothing, you know, in terms of genetic, you know, difference. And so it's just, you know, that history, it's just, it'll be interesting to see how they process all of that. And then also what I do for a living, you know,
yeah,
with these stories. And they're, I mean, my daughter knows Julie. They know all the songs, you know.
Julie, oh, Julie, won't you lie? If they find that trunk of gold by my side, Julie, oh, Julie, you tell them, men, that trunk of gold is yours, my friend. Mistress, oh mistress, I won't lie. If they find that trunk of gold by your side, mistress, oh mistress, that trunk of gold is what you got when my children you sold.
You have to perform that on tour over and over again.
Yeah, it's
probably thinking of your own kids, do you not?
Well, that one, you know, I was just talking about this to somebody last night. It is pretty intense because it's not just that one. There's like multiple songs,
yeah,
you know, with dealing with this. And you know, but what I always like to say is that they lived it. I can sing about it. You know, it's the least I can do is to sing about it. They lived through this. I'm not living this. So if I can't sing it, you know what I mean? And it's like, figuring out how to, you know, get myself and my soul, you know, centered and grounded so that I can go there night after night and not burn myself out. I mean, that's my trick. That's the trick to figure out. But ultimately, it's like all I'm doing is singing about it and I'm conjuring them up. And that sure as heck beats, you know, living that life that they had to live. So you know what? I'm okay with it.
That's singer-songwriter Rhiannon Giddens speaking with my colleague Celeste Headley. Giddens was recently announced as one of the MacArthur Foundation's Genius Grant winners. Here's her song, At the Purchaser's Option, off her latest album, Freedom Highway.
I've got a babe, but shall I keep him? 'Twill come the day when I'll be weeping.
Just ahead, a novel takes us back to a time when neighborhoods were segregated and black police officers were few and far between. But first, interactions between police and African Americans now. This is On Second Thought.
You can take my body, you can take my bones, you can take my blood, but not my soul. You can take my body, you can take my bones, you can take my blood, but not my soul.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headley. Earlier this month, Vice President Mike Pence left an Indianapolis Colts game to protest players kneeling during the national anthem. It's something that athletes across the country, including Atlanta, are doing on the field to protest police violence against African Americans. Amir Muhammad of Atlanta says he wants his own experience with police to be a learning experience for his children. Here he is with his son, Fahim.
And my name is Amir Muhammad, and I'm here with my son, Fahim Muhammad. You're only, how old are you now, 14?
Yes. Did you ever have any tense experiences with law enforcement?
I was in the ninth grade, and we had a basketball game. So I was fully dressed with my sweats, my shorts on. And so I was walking over a friend's house, and his mom was going to take us to the game. And this white police officer just rolls up really fast and stops his car and jumps out and just yells at me, "Where are you going?" So I looked at him and I didn't answer him. And he said, "You heard me." I said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "Where does it look like I'm going?" He said, "Open your bag up." And I looked at him. I was like, "For what?" And he said, "I'm not going to tell you again." And he put his hand on his gun. So when I told my dad, told him the tone in which the conversation was, and he just told me, "Don't let it be easy for them to take you out." And so I learned as well to just let that cop have his way, and then we'll live to fight another day. That's just one of several incidents that I had. But that was like the first one when I was 14 years old.
At what point did you realize you wanted us as a family to talk about how we handle ourselves around police?
I had that conversation with you guys early, and you guys have seen some of the good and bad sitting in the back seat. The time where you were asleep and that cop made us wait for like an hour to write a ticket when we pulled in our own complex, and he made us wait an hour to write a ticket for really nothing, something that we ended up getting thrown out in court. So if you escalate a situation, then your kids are going to grow up thinking that it's okay to escalate situations with police officers. And that's not good to teach them that, because if a police officer says, "Well, he looked like he was reaching for something," that's it. That's all they have to, I mean, it's been proven that they're going to get off from that. You know, when they go out on a day-to-day, you don't wake up saying, "My child is going to die from a police officer today." So they're going to imitate what they see you do. So if you ever are in that situation, you make that a positive, teachable moment. What was going through your mind when we talked about, you know, situations about race and with the police officers?
I was just thinking of stuff that I had seen before and then like went over my head at the time, and then now I knew exactly what it was.
And so does that make you worry, or now are you concerned about your safety with police?
It makes me cautious. Like, just walking past a police officer, I'm not going to get scared and worry and tense, but I'm just going to be cautious of what I do around police officers.
Just that. Do you think that that is something that's fair?
Yeah, that's not fair at all. I mean, they are supposed to be the ones you are supposed to feel safe around, but it's the opposite with black people. It's like we feel less safe around them.
That was Amir Muhammad of Atlanta speaking with his 14-year-old son, Fahim. Their conversation was produced by GPB intern Maya Martin. In the Jim Crow South, black and white neighborhoods were separate by law. Some police departments added African-American officers to their squads to cover the black communities. Atlanta hired 8 men in 1948, but their authority was greatly restricted. These officers inspired Thomas Mullen's novel, Darktown. My colleague Celeste Headley talked to Thomas this year about the sequel, Lightning Men.
Let's first talk about that title, because it refers to a specific thing. Who are the Lightning Men?
So Lightning Men refers to a group that existed in Atlanta. It was our very own homegrown fascist organization. They called themselves the Columbians. They dressed in Nazi brown shirts, complete with SS lightning bolt patches on their sleeve, designed after the Nazi stormtrooper lightning bolt. And they made it a point of showing up in neighborhoods where African-Americans had bought a house in previously white-only neighborhoods, and showing up to intimidate them and start fights. They recruited other adherents at mills around town, and they finally got shut down in the late 40s when they went even further than that and advocated overthrowing the state government.
And what was interesting to me was that I would have assumed they would have been in league with, or at least friendly with, the KKK, but your books suggest that was not the case.
Yeah, there are all sorts of different variations of white supremacy. And you had the Ku Klux Klan, obviously, and then you had the Columbians. The KKK kind of looked down on the Columbians as these goofy kid dropouts who were a little too enamored with Hitler. Remember, this is after World War II. This is after we fought a war to defeat fascism. And a few years later, here we have a Nazi-style group operating in Atlanta. So the Klan kind of looked down their noses at them. But then you also had neighborhood associations that looked down at the Klan, even though they really wanted the same thing, which was to keep blacks out of white neighborhoods.
I mean, it makes it sound like we're talking about a history book. And really, this is a mystery slash thriller at its heart. The problem for me is that it's really hard to talk about any plot points without spoiling, because you get a spoiler almost from the very beginning of the novel. The character of the first person who gets out of prison and is released is someone that I can't say who that is, because who he
yeah,
is
that's true.
Is important. But he says this one thing, and I want to read it. The character named Jeremiah, he's just out of prison, and they have the cops have set up a system whereby they can somebody's released from prison can be sent back almost immediately to prison. And he says, "Why do they act this way? I don't understand this world, not this world meaning the outside as opposed to prison, but this world meaning everything." Does that sentiment change at all by the end?
Maybe.
As a symbol, I guess.
Maybe not for him, but I mean, all the characters are trying to understand what's going on in this crazy world. And it was a time of great change. I mean, it was right before a lot of the seminal victories of the civil rights movement that we learn about in school. Like the Montgomery bus boycott is going to be in 55, and Brown versus Board of Education is going to be in 54, but this book is set in 50. So all of those currents and threads are still going on at that time, but nothing's happened yet. And within the black community at this time, there's also a sense of disappointment. People thought there were going to be a lot of changes with World War II, since, you know, we fought a war to defeat fascism, and African-American newspapers thought that we should also be fighting to overthrow Jim Crow at the same time. They called it the Double V campaign, the Double V campaign for victory over fascism and victory over Jim Crow. But that hadn't quite happened yet. And so I think there was a lot of confusion going on all sides. The world had just gone through so much change with the Depression, with the war, and everybody was kind of wondering what's going to happen next.
There's a point in there where you're, as a novelist, are imagining how these sort of backroom deals had to be made. And it's one where they're sort of, they're negotiating where the lines of segregation will be drawn in a neighborhood. And it struck me because many people think of the Atlanta Way, capital Atlanta, capital Way, as something to be proud of. That's how Atlanta has escaped a lot of the racial turmoil that has beset other cities like Los Angeles or Detroit or New York. But in your book, the Atlanta Way kind of feels a little bit gross.
Interesting.
It feels a little bit like people simply not taking a stand or avoiding conflict in order to keep the peace when they really needed to have the conflict. And that was all coming out of your imagination, or really my question is, how much did you find out about how these deals were made or not?
I tried to make that as based on fact as possible. So I am a novelist. This is fiction. And so I'm going to exploit things for tension and suspense as much as I can. But I want the surrounding world and the politics to be as dead on accurate as possible. And you create my little fictional events within that structure. And the Atlanta Way, it can look that way. It can look a little backward looking back through time, especially, you know, after the mid-60s when you had this generational change within the civil rights leadership and, you know, a younger generation that came of age in about 60, 61, 62, saying, like, we're tired of the way that our fathers are going about it, this incrementalism, this asking for crumbs off the white man's table. We need to push harder. And, you know, obviously it's easy to agree with that now. In 1950, it was more complicated because, you know, Atlanta was only 40 some odd years removed from a race riot where whites rioted and attacked blacks and drove them out of downtown. So for black community leaders at that time, you know, they were working hard to win concessions from the white majority, concessions like black officers hired in 1948, concessions like allowing certain neighborhoods that had previously been all white, you know, opening those up African Americans. And that's a scene in the book that you're referring to where some black community leaders sit down with white community leaders and try to negotiate, okay, well, where can black families move into safely? And looking back on it now, and one of the characters in the book, a young police officer, he's angered by this. He's like, well, we're bartering away where we can live. This is America. We should be able to live wherever we want. That's the perspective of Officer Lucius Boggs, who's kind of sickened by these negotiations that he observes. But his father, Reverend Boggs, who I see as a contemporary of Martin Luther King Sr., you know, the older wave of leadership at that time, you know, he feels like we're doing what we can to avoid another race riot. We're doing what we can to make things better for our people while avoiding violence. And, you know, I've worked hard to get this far. I don't want to hear you criticizing me. And that was a generational conflict that, you know, we would see more of in the years ahead.
So I want to read, I alluded earlier to the white detective who decides he's putting his family in danger by helping African Americans. He doesn't want to do this anymore. And his family situation gets very complicated in this book in a really interesting way. But it says, if any Negro officer ever asked another favor of him, he would decline. He wouldn't spit in their faces, no, but neither would he take a single risk for their cause ever again. He had his own battles to fight, and he couldn't afford to weaken himself by associating with the troubles that shadowed their every step. How much did you try to imagine yourself in the same position? To what extent did you think to yourself, well, what would I have done?
Well, first I should mention that passage you read is very late in the book. So a lot has gone on to get him to that point. And when I wrote this book and when I wrote the previous book, Darktown, you know, I was aware of the fact that in a lot of other books about race written by white people or films about race, starring a lot of white Hollywood actors, there's this character that kind of gets created of the white savior, where even if it's a story about civil rights in which you would think African American should be starring, or at the very least playing a very pivotal role. Weirdly, through some alchemy, the story winds up being about, you know, saving the soul of the white people, or the white people finally stepping up and doing the right thing. And although that is important, I didn't want that to happen with my book. And so there is this character of Dennis Rakestraw. He goes by Rake. He's a white cop, and he wants to be better than a lot of the white cops around him. He's not a violent thug. He's not a racist. He was raised in a household where you didn't use racial epithets and things like that. So he wants to do better, and he wants to see the black cops succeed. But one of the reasons he wants to see them succeed is because if the black cops succeed and the city hires more of them, then the city will have enough black cops to patrol all the black neighborhoods, and white cops like Rape will never have to go to a black. Yeah, exactly. Because even progressive-minded whites back then still had a hard time imagining a world without segregation. So he's being pushed in the previous book and in this book to try to do the right thing and kind of cross the color line to help.
Did you know the end of the book before you started writing?
Gosh, that's a good question. I don't know if I remember anymore. Usually I have a pretty good idea of where I'm going, but I don't know exactly how I'm going to get there. So there's a few scenes towards the end that I had to figure some things out, especially with a crime novel where you have various intersecting plot lines. You want to make sure they make sense. And sometimes I'll be writing a book and I'll think, okay, this character is going to have a deep, dark secret, and I don't know what it is yet. And as I'm writing, I'll eventually figure it out, or I'll be doing some research and I'll discover some interesting thing that happened. I was like, ooh, I'm going to borrow that. So I think I knew most of it, but some of it was stuff that I worked out as I went.
And is this part of a trilogy?
I'm not going to limit myself to three. I think it's kind of fun. When I had the idea for Darktown, which was set in 48 when the city first hired its 8 black cops, I was struck by the fact that it's right before the civil rights movement really takes off and that so much is going to change in Atlanta, in the South, and in America over the next 20 years. And as I was writing Darktown, it was getting longer and longer, and I was coming up with more subplots and more characters, and I quickly realized, you know, this could easily become like an 800-page doorstop of a novel if I wasn't careful. And I didn't want that to happen because not many people want to read 800-page novels. So I held some things back. So there were things in Lightning Men that I had initially been writing to go into Darktown that I later decided to pull back and save for a later book. So I don't have a magic number in mind, but I think there's a lot of different stories worth telling. And I think it'd be interesting to see what happens to some of these officers. You know, in 55, when the Montgomery bus boycott's going on and Martin Luther King Jr., a native Atlantan, becomes a national figure. What happens in 1960 when King moves to Atlanta at the same time that this younger generation of civil rights activists, you know, takes over and there are more demonstrations in Atlanta than there had been before? You know, what happens in the mid-60s? Like, it's interesting to trace the evolution of Atlanta and the evolution of our country, and you marry that to crime stories sort of as a, like the spoonful of sugar that makes maybe a reader able to embrace what can otherwise be difficult, heavy material.
Have you heard from any cops after they read Darktown? Did you hear from actual officers?
I've spoken with a few officers. I'm not sure how many I've spoken with who'd read the book first.
Or admitted it.
Yeah. But I mean, a lot of people have been interested in it. And when I've given talks, some cops have come up to me afterwards, or people who were former officers, or whose dad or uncle or cousin or sister was a cop, and have shared different stories they've told, not just in Atlanta, but in other parts of the country, and how, you know, different police departments have been integrated better than others. And in some cities, it took a long time before white and black cops could work together well.
Did you get any good ideas from these stories that you heard from either the cops or their family?
Yeah, some. I'm always filing away little ideas because since I want to write a number of these books, I've got a giant piece of paper at home, 2 giant pieces of paper with different post-it notes, color-coded subplot ideas or character ideas or historical event ideas that I'm kind of rearranging as I go. But it's been fun. It's been fun to have a project like this. And it's been fun for me, you know, an excuse to learn more about Atlanta history and become more, you know, bound to the area that I live in.
But the people at the library near you must know your face and name.
At this point, I think so. But there's a few different libraries I make a habit of going to, so I'm going to different parts of the city.
That's Atlanta-based author Thomas Mullen speaking with Celeste Headley. Mullen is author of the bestseller Darktown. His latest novel is the sequel, Lightning Men. And that's it for our show today, but we want to hear from you. How do you talk about sensitive issues at home? Issues like conflicts with police? Call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457 or reach us on Twitter at OSTTalk. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headley. Have a good one.